Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power with Donna Sebo here speaking. We have got an interesting conversation that we're going to be experiencing today because it's going into literary history. My guest today is Keith Newland, and he's written a book called Hamlin Garland, A Life. And I have to tell you, I didn't know anything about this man. And by the time I finished this book, I had such an awareness of an individual who played an extremely powerful part in the literary world, affecting so many things in life in so many ways. Keith, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you really gave me an education. I can't talk about anybody else that has read your book. But I was astonished to learn about this man and how he received 4 honorary doctorates and a Pulitzer Prize. He came from what someone might say a very insignificant, not a very colorful background at all. Actually, when you read the story, sometimes it's sort of depressing. Yet out of this came this man who had such a standard for excellence and wrote so fabulously, and he also believed in spiritualism. I mean, this was really interesting reading. Whatever prompted you to explore the life of Hamlin Garland? How did you become aware of this man? How did he touch your mind and spirit so that you decided you wanted to dedicate your time to doing this?
Well, it's actually a long story. It began by reading one of his collections of short stories, Under a Tree During a Rainstorm, and Maine Traveled Roads, when I was in my early 20s, and backpacking in the Rockies. And when I was in graduate school, I read one of his plays, and it was a fascinating play, and it became part of the subject of my dissertation. And when I had finished that dissertation, in the meantime, I had gone to the Maine Garland Archive in California and read through his papers and his letters, and decided that this was a significant writer who had largely been forgotten, and I produced co-edited a collection of his letters. And when I finished that, I realized I'd learned a lot about this man that no one else knew, and I needed to leave a record for posterity, and that was the birth of the biography.
He is such an interesting man, and I know that you had access to all kinds of materials that you went through. He was the Dean of American Letters. He died on March 14th, 1940. He was really, relative to the way we think today, he wasn't that old a man when he passed away.
Well, he was almost 80.
Oh, he was almost 80.
Yeah.
Okay, I beg your pardon. I was thinking that he was younger than that when he passed away. But he just is amazing, and I'll quote from your book here. He knew virtually every significant writer of his day, both in the United States and England, had again won a Pulitzer Prize, dined with presidents. He had traveled among Indians and learned sign language to communicate with them, and wrote some of the most sympathetic stories of his time about Native Americans. He published, during one two-year period, he published 4 books, lectured throughout the United States, made repeated trips to the West to study conditions on the reservations, embarked on a 5-month, 1,000-mile trek through the Canadian wilderness to prospect for gold in the Klondike, sailed to Europe to arrange for British publication of his books. He gets married. This man had such an interesting life, yet he didn't really feel like he had accomplished that much, did he?
No, he didn't, and partly it was envy. Since he knew so many famous writers and good writers, and many of whom had really struck a hit with the public, and became best-selling authors and were rolling in money. Garland's success was much more moderate, so he really got struck by the envy bug. And he would compare, and he admits in his diary one day, that compared to his the boys he grew up with on the Iowa prairie, he's a marvel, but compared to the success of his peers, he's a failure. He wasn't a failure, he's putting it too strongly. But, you know, they were selling hundreds of thousands of copies, and he was selling thousands of copies.
Mm-hmm.
They had hundreds of thousands of dollars. He was getting thousands of dollars. So it was really envy, which led to this feeling of inadequacy. Also, his upbringing. He grew up on a frontier farm. When he was 10 years old, he had to drive a sod-breaking plow through the prairie 10 hours a day, which was a lot of work for a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Largely educated himself. So there's always a touch of not feeling like he belonged.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, was in part responsible for his feelings of inadequacy.
Now, I want to let my listeners know a little bit about you. You're a professor of English at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and you're a co-editor of the journal Studies in American Naturalism, and also the co-editor of Selected Letters of Hamlin Garland that you've done, and editor of a forthcoming book by Isabel Garland Lord, A Summer to Be, a memoir by the daughter of Hamlin Garland. So you're a man that this particular individual, you are really becoming very much involved in so much of his life, and that was obvious from the way that you put your material together, that you really had not only a deep respect and regard for the man, but you also were willing to look at his frailties. I want to go back to the pioneering period, because I think in our world of high tech today, it often is very difficult for us to really get a clear picture of that pioneering kind of an environment. We have pioneers today, but they're of a different, of a different feel. This was really a very harsh, hard reality. And his father, tell us a little bit about his dad, because his dad was quite an individual.
Yes. His father's Richard Garland, emigrated from a poor town and farm in Maine, and made his way eventually to Wisconsin just after Wisconsin became a state. And he set out to claim a homestead. And the area of Wisconsin he settled in was known as the Coulee region, and that's basically it's a French word for a narrow, deep ravine. And the farmland was narrow, deep, and rocky, not the best for farms. So as the land opened up further west, which means as the white invaders pushed off the Indians, they'd grab the land. And so he moved westward looking for flatter land, and so it'd make a living easier as a farmer. And eventually, in 1870, he settled in Iowa just after the Indians had been removed, and it was a virgin prairie. And there he started laying claim to acreage, and Hamlin was put to work driving a plow. So, child labor on a farm was very much reality. So it was harsh, with blizzards and building a house and trying to make a living. But then the chinch bug came and started blighting crops. So he had to move yet again further west to what was then Dakota Territory, and set up yet another homestead. So Hamlin's earliest memories were of being moved from frontier farm to frontier farm, further westward, each time harsher living conditions.
Now, his mother, her name was Edith, I believe.
Isabel,
excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And his mother was so unlike his father, and yet, like so many women of that time, they went, wherever their husbands went.
Right.
And life for her was very, very hard, extremely hard. And he was extremely close to his mother, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. His father was fairly distant, and partly because right after he was born, his father enlisted in the Civil War and went away. And when he came back at the end of that, I think he was in for a total of 3 years. That military discipline had affected his outlook on child raising.
Mm-hmm.
And he was tended to be quite the disciplinarian. Hamlin had two sisters and a brother, all younger, he's the oldest. And his mother was, by temperament, much more jovial, more artistic, more musical. Her side of the family were all musicians and so forth. But in fact, at that time, it was very difficult to make a living, from the land. We tend to forget that this is an era before electricity, when the women sewed the clothes that you wore, when any food you had in the winter is food that you had to preserve.
Mm-hmm.
There was never a day of rest for the farm wife. And Hamlin naturally turned from his disciplinarian father to his more nurturing mother and developed quite the protective streak toward her. And, the Freudians would have a field day with him now, looking at the, they'd call him a boy with a mother problem. But, but that was a very common reaction at the time.
I'm going to quote something that Hamlin wrote in 1888. He said, "This farm life, it will be seen, was attractive, not because of the home life so much or because of the superb setting of color and light in the atmosphere and landscape, but not even the beauty of the landscape could compensate for the endless grind of hard physical labor, especially for the farm wife who toiled without cessation. Slaves on a treadmill or in the Roman galleys could not have endured greater hardships than many of these women. Sallow, weazened, old before their time, with a dull, patient, hopeless look on their faces, condemned to a life of littleness and vanity, occupied in running from stove to pantry, from cradle to frying pan, life was a prison for the patient women who had long since abandoned hope." Oh, my goodness. I read that, and I just went, I'm glad I'm not living then.
Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm aware of that. I have known people that have lived that kind of a life.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of the Dakotas, they could be so bleak. And like you said, this, the agricultural side, a lot of the land that was given to people for literally pennies, so much of it was worthless for farming. And but you had the environment. We didn't have the deer plows and all this kind of stuff
right.
available. It was total physical, hard labor.
Yeah. Garland made his reputation with his first collection of stories in 1991 called Maine Traveled Roads with stories about that life on the farm. He was really the first American writer to describe what conditions on the farm life were like with any accuracy. Until that time, the farm was seen as kind of a wholesome, nurturing kind of place where, as Garland once said in one of his writings, where farmers go around yodeling. But that's not the way it was. And he received considerable controversy with the publication of his stories because it punctured this myth of what the American farm was like.
Mm-hmm.
That's passages such as the one you read.
Now, one of his sisters, Harriet, died when he was 14, and that was so tragic. It's something that in today's world, it's not easy for us to understand or to see.
Mm-hmm.
But there weren't vaccines at that time. Fevers would go around so quickly, and often entire communities were wiped out because mm-hmm. of no doctors. You know, there wasn't anyone around to assist them. They didn't have the medicines or even sometimes the understanding of herbs or whatever they could use to beat
right.
them. They didn't know what it was, but her death was shown to be typhoid pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept a daily diary, which just left an abundance of information.
Mm-hmm. Though not about that. His brother had given him his first diary when he was 15. And that diary, it's very small. It's only about 3 inches by 2 inches, very tiny diary. And he basically recorded the weather. Who knows why? But at 15, what did he know? And on the day his sister died, he recorded that he'd gone for the doctor and that Harriet had died and that it was sunny, I think. And that was
mm-hmm.
basically it, no emotional reaction. That sort of writing would come later. In 1898, he began keeping an extensive daily diary, which he later used in his writing. It was very very fortunate find to find 43 years of daily diaries, which helped enormously in constructing his life.
Now, at a very young age, you said he learned that social organizations formed to improve the lot of others while also providing pleasant company, can do as much for the social good as any overt political activity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at the base of what he ended up doing in the future. He was very much, to my surprise, a strong advocate of the independence of women, a strong advocate of education, a strong advocate of the protection of the rights of Indians on so many levels where he wasn't in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many parts of his life that formed a foundation that he really built upon as a mature adult.
Mm-hmm. He had a friend, Henry Fuller, who called him a club carpenter and joiner. And he did put together a lot of these, but they were all founded on that principle that people coming together with mutual social interest will naturally work together to improve a lot of themselves and others. But he was early on a reformer, and that reform spirit affected these clubs that he helped form, but his entire outlook on life. For Hamlin, writing was definitely for a purpose. He wanted to change people's lives and make them better. He did start out with his very first fiction.
Now, he also had very strong lessons about the differences in class.
Mm-hmm.
He being a farm boy and having gone through some pretty hurtful experiences, he never forgot that. And that was something that stayed with him all of his life. He never forgot his roots.
Well, with one qualification. When he got older, he became much more conservative and much less tolerant. One of the ugly parts of his diaries is in the 20s, after the Eastern European immigrants begin arriving in New York City, where he's living, he is very much aware that his sort of American background is being changed by the immigrants. And that does affect his outlook. There is some unsavory correspondence where he talks about the unwashed Lithuanians or big-nosed Jews and things
mm-hmm.
like that. He tried to be open, but he's very much a product of his age. And this was a very racist time in our
mm-hmm.
history. And, you know, he's affected by it. Not as much as some writers, but it's definitely there.
Very interesting observation. Now, he really defied his father when he decided that he was going to go on with school, because
mm-hmm.
his father was never a man that really was that supportive of education, but his mother was, wasn't she?
Yes. We have to remember at that time that nowadays education, as everyone claims, is a right and an expectation. That wasn't true in Hamlin's time. It was very much an elitist sort of thing, very much an exception to go to college, not the rule.
Mm-hmm.
And so people made their fortunes in business and in land acquisition and the trades and so forth. And that was the usual path to success, and that's the path his father expected him to take. So for Hamlin to say, I don't want to be a farmer. I want to be an intellectual, which is basically what he tells him. You know, his father must have thrown up his hands in horror. What kind of money can a person who works with his brain make?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's really the root of that. It's just a very different outlook on life, and one that's not so far away today. I still hear from my students whose parents wonder, why are you an English major? How are you going to make a living?
Mm-hmm.
They ask, how is your table waiting skills? You know, that's the expectation. So that attitude hasn't changed that much.
Well, I think there's that very practical side of life, especially if people have seen very difficult times. And
right.
they'll say, well, this is wonderful, but what are you going to do? Again, just what you said, how are you going to make a living? The world changes, but it doesn't change.
Right.
And so education is something always that, whether you are self-educated, as Hamlin was in many respects, there has to be something within the person that says, I want something better. Just existing is not enough. And the more you can educate your mind, of course, the better it is. And this man went on to accomplish quite a bit. But he also had to learn about money and
yeah.
how he learned about money. Give us a couple of examples, because that wasn't something that was important when he was growing up, but it wasn't important. What were some of the significant lessons for him relative to money?
What can you tell me more about what you mean by relative
well,
money?
There was a time when he was trying to find a teaching job, and he was exhausted, and he ended up having a bag.
You're thinking of the time when he's very young. He's 18 or so.
Right.
And he's tramping, and he runs out of money, and he does what a lot of people do, and that is he has to knock on a door and basically beg for a room for the night. And that horrified him. And he never wanted to be placed in that position of having to beg, and resolved that he would always have some money or the means to earn money. This, by the way, was in the winter, so he couldn't simply go work in a field.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an early lesson. But he also, because of his upbringing, he knew that money was important, and he was he knew that if he wanted to make a living, he had to earn money. And the remarkable thing is he did it entirely through writing and lecturing. Even today, that's a very difficult task, to earn your living solely from writing.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the writers I know are also professors of creative writing in universities, and their principal paycheck comes from teaching. And the writing that they manage to sell to magazines or to publishers is just a part of it. But Hamblin was one of those rare people who made his living entirely through writing or through public speaking, getting lecture fees. Once he, in his mid-20s, he was teaching at a school in Boston and went on a lecture circuit, and that was the beginning. From then on, he never had a steady job. He actually never worked for wages. He worked entirely for fees and for royalties.
He knew so many significant writers, one of which was Walt Whitman. And he said that Walt Whitman had taught him two great and searching truths, optimism and altruism, hope mm-hmm. for the future, and sympathy towards men. And he was at Whitman's 70th birthday party on May 31st, 1889. It is so amazing when you start reading his story, where he started out, no electricity, the technology available was in its most minimal expression at that time compared to where we are today. In his lifetime, technology really sped up. The Industrial Revolution was in flux, not in flux, but was in its own momentum, was building. And yet this is a man that ends up going to the Klondike. He ends up traveling to Indian reservations, gaining new perspectives. This man had the soul of an adventurer.
He had quite a bit of wanderlust, and that's something that took years to die down. When he was, up until he was almost 40, he was rarely in one place longer than a month. He was constantly on the go. And even after he got married, his wife was fortunately adventurous, and they traveled until the kids arrived. But he was constantly in motion. He had an eager appetite for new adventures. And I suppose this is part of his father's wanderlust that he may have inherited.
And so much of what he experienced, he put it into his writing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was known for his depiction of that time frame in life. And he had a very special man who was his editor. Tell us about his editor.
Well, there were three significant ones. Are you thinking of Benjamin Flower, or Harold Latham, or George Brett? I'm not sure which one. He had a number of editors who were very influential.
Well, Henry B. Fuller is one man that I'm thinking of.
He's a friend. He turned to his friend for advice, not really an editor, but a friend who turned his manuscripts over to him. And ask him for recommendations for revision. But basically, his literary conscience is his chief confidant, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Fuller was quite an interesting man. Flower is the one I think I wanted to focus on because he did a lot of the early work.
Yeah, Flower was a struggling writer's dream. Flower published a muckraking magazine called The Arena, and the title tells you what it was intended to do. It was to be an arena for debate of ideas. And this is in the early 1890s, and this is a time when Garland is full flower, his most vehement, his most protesting, his most cause-driven. And he'd been writing these stories and essays and struggling to find an outlet for them because they were pretty radical. And he sends them to Flower, who writes back, he paused in after like a couple pages to write Garland a letter and said, I notice that you seem to hesitate in speaking your mind. I want you to feel perfectly free to speak your mind fully and completely and say anything you want. And thereafter, he basically published everything Garland sent to him and reached the sort of audience that he wanted to reach, the radicals.
Now, he was behind the founding of a number of different organizations which exist even today. His marriage was very interesting because he was married to, I believe his wife's name is Constance. And
now, Constance is a daughter. His wife's name was Zulami.
Okay, there we go. I had the wrong name.
Yeah.
Yes. And she was quite a fascinating woman because she fell in love with another man.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a... They really weren't too happy together.
No, there was struggle. You have to remember that Garland, when Garland gets married, he is 39 years old, and he has spent the last 20 years of his life basically wandering, and very much in the public eye, very much a figure of debate in the magazines, people ridiculing him right and left. He got a lot of personal abuse for his views. He meets a woman who is 10 years his junior, who comes from an artistic family. She was an artist who trained in the salons of Paris. She comes from an interesting family. Her father and mother must have been peculiar. They named the kids this, Loredo Zadok, Zulame Mauna, Florizel Adino, and Turbulence Doctoria. Can you believe that for the names?
They called
her Aunt Kirby. And they were all artistic. Her brother, Loredo Taft, was a renowned sculptor, and his sculptures are still in Chicago and at the Art Institute. And Zulami was an artist who exhibited at the World's Fair in 1893. There were features on her in the magazines on what was then called girl sculptors. And Hamlin met her first then, but since she was enamored with French art, he thought that she should have been more devoted to American art, and apparently they had words and he didn't make much of an impression. He meets her again a few years later after she comes back, and they start courting, but he learns from her brother that she is engaged to another man, which isn't true. Her brother simply didn't want his best friend dating his sister. So he abruptly leaves and goes to Europe. When he comes back, he renews acquaintance with Zulami again. And this time he thinks his friend Henry Fuller is his rival because Fuller has seen quite a bit of him. What he doesn't know about Fuller at that point is that Fuller is gay,
mm-hmm.
And very much in the closet. But eventually they start courting, and their courtship is not the usual romantic kind of thing. He was basically looking for a comrade. And was not a romantic proposal. It was more of a very practical sort of arrangement that they arrived at. And what we learn later from his mother later confessed to the daughter, that she wasn't in love with him when she married him, that he was famous, he was good-looking. Her brother liked him a lot. He was very much in the public eye. And she thought that she needed to marry someone. Why not Hamlin? And I think what happened is, they had some difficulty, as couples do, getting used to each other right after the marriage, particularly when you're older and pretty much set in your ways. And Hamlin is on the road a great deal. And there's this mysterious character that his daughter calls Uncle Larry, which that doesn't say much more than that, that apparently won Zulami's heart. And she had to decide whether to go off with this man or stay with Hamlin and her... very young daughter. They did.
Mm-hmm. And so she stayed.
Yeah.
Well, this man's life is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
His support of women and the education of women and then being able to have lives because he watched his mother deteriorate so badly, it just broke his heart when he knew what she had gone through. And there's just so much here. It's an American story that I just think is awesome. Hamlin Garland, A Life. Keith, do you have a website on this?
I do. You can Google my name, and it will be the first thing that comes up.
So that's Keith Newland, K-E-I-T-H-N-E-W-L-I-N.
Mm-hmm.
Just Google that name in, and then that information will pop up.
That's right.
Keith, it's been a delight. You've done an incredible job with this man's story. He is someone that is worthy of being remembered, not only because of who he was and the accomplishments that he attained, but the influence that he had on his time frame, even though he felt like at the time that he passed away that his life didn't have much value. He would never be remembered. It looks to me like you have done a significant job in turning that around.
Well, thank you very much.
It's been a delight having you, Keith.
I've loved
Donna
being
Siebel
on your show, and I look forward to listening to more.
Wonderful. This is Donna Siebel. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away. We've got to take a break.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyND.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Siebel on her show on bbsradio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you. Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyND.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Siebel on her show on bbsradio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Siebel. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna Siebel. Telephone lines are now open. If you would like to call in and chat, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here are some telephone numbers to call in to, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Also, Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And we also have a direct line of 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. And all I need from you is your first name or your initial. Let me share with you my thoughts and perceptions. And then after that, you're welcome to ask me anything you like. It's summertime here. Oh, it's so great. The sun's out in the Pacific Northwest. We didn't think it was going to come out today. You know, we're known for our gray skies. Well, we had it completely gray for most of the day today. But the sun has decided to come out. The temperatures are warm, and it's absolutely delightful. Well, if you're like me, you don't want to spend a heck of a lot of time in the kitchen. But summertime is a great time to interact with friends and sit out on your deck and go places. Well, I know we've got a caller. I have got two recipes I want to share with you today. One is for stuffed mushrooms, and the other one is cheese balls. And these are little things that you can put together, and it's fabulous. They serve beautifully. They're nice for munching. They're not heavy. Great for hot weather. So get that pad of paper and pen together, because we're going to be talking food in a little bit. Meanwhile, let's go to our caller. Thank you for waiting. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
From Ben Lomond.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Your voice is very faint. Where are you calling from again, sir?
D is my initial.
Oh, okay.
And I'm from Ben Lomond.
Where's that?
Outside of Scotts Valley or Santa Cruz.
Oh, you're in California. Oh, my goodness. I've never heard of that. Oh, Santa Cruz is gorgeous. Oh, I just think Santa Cruz is one of the most beautiful places around. Just absolutely awesome. Okay, Dee, let's get down to business with you. The first thing that I am looking at are two words, lighten up. You're getting the feeling of pressure, and I feel like someone has got me in a cylinder, and they keep lowering the top of the cylinder, and I'm just getting this feeling of being in a vacuum. I want you to know this is only temporary. You're not stuck. You're going to be able to have some relief, but if you lighten up a little bit, then you're going to find that you have some flexibility. There is an oppressiveness of intense thought. It's as if I want you to go out, take a walk around the block, go play ping pong, do something that is out of the norm to get yourself out of this mental intensity. Because when you take a break, it's like a breath of fresh air, and then you're able to bring things together into a clear perspective. And this is very important for you. You've got some pretty big projects you're going to be working on, and they're going to demand phenomenal concentration on your part. I want you to be able to do it. I want you to be able to enjoy it. And I want you to be able to feel a sense of rhythm in how you work. But if you go totally into the mental sphere and you don't take breaks periodically, you're going to just feel like you're suffocating, and I don't want you to do that. So realize that you've got a very intense sense of responsibility going along with what could be a very intense schedule, and you can break it up so that is relieved, so that you have breathing room. And the two words, lighten up, are going to be very important to you. And when you find yourself getting too serious about things too intensely, if you'll just remember those two words, that'll enable you to break away and allow yourself to relax. And I'm picking up something with your eyes. It could be you're working on a computer too much, you're reading too much. There is a lot of stress with the eyes. And what I'd recommend is if you have tea bags, so if you enjoy tea, drink the tea, save the tea bags, put them in the refrigerator, and when your eyes feel especially fatigued, lay down on the floor, lift up your feet about 6 inches off the floor with some pillows or something else, put the cold tea bags on your eyes, and you'll be refreshed. Make it about a 15-minute break, and it'll do wonders for you. But again, use tea bags with just do fabulous, and you won't end up with great big brown circles around your eyes either. It won't stain your skin. Just know that the coldness of the used tea bags will really be very, very refreshing. What's on your mind? What would you like to ask me today?
Well, I'm I've been working on a project for about a year, and I've come to a crossroads, and I want to know whether I should run a business out of it, rent it out, or sell it.
What's the project?
It's a commercial property with a couple of buildings on it that can be an antique center with food and maybe a wine bar, that kind of thing.
Well, I think you've made a very good investment. I think you will be renting a portion of it out. What I'd like for you to do is to investigate your area. Look at about a 20-mile radius around the business. Are there any changes that are coming in? Any new developments? Any shopping centers? Housing developments, excuse me. Anything that is going to make you aware of some imminent changes that are evolving during the next 5 years. If you are able to get a good assessment, talk to people at the Chamber of Commerce, just talk to realtors, be an investigator. What you will find is that partially renting it would be a very good idea, and you need to do some homework if you would want to have a business of your own that you would oversee. What is it that you'd want to give your time to? And if you're wanting to make it a part-time business, then you need to look at how much space you would want to use for it. So I think you could do this in increments. I think being able to rent out the location of the space that you have, the various aspects of it, look at what you possibly could do with it. How much space would you want it to be broken up into? What's your square footage that you would like to rent out? And then break it down and maybe talk with a couple of other people that you have respect for that would give you some good feedback. And I think within 6 months, maybe a little bit more like 8 months, you would be able to get the kind of people you would want to have in there that would be of a good, sound business, number one. Two would have a great reputation behind them that they would really do well in the space. And three, who are willing to work with the time frame that it will take for them to get the most exposure for the environment that they're in. So I think you've got a lot going for you here. I do not think this was a bad investment at all. I think there's a combination of what you're going to do here. It's not an either or. At least in my mind's view, it's a combination. Am I making sense to you?
Yes.
Good. Well, I think you've done a good job.
Thank you.
So if you've brought it all up to par, the electrical wiring, everything else, just make sure that you talk with your attorney, look at all of the areas of leasing agreements and everything else that you'd want to have, and then just determine what kind of a business you really want there. And if you are going to have an opportunity to serve food or someone would have that, you want to have people that are going to be conscientious and meet up all the requirements from the health department, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling in, Dee.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo. And if you'd like to call in like Dee did, here are the telephone numbers that you can ring. 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Or you can call the direct line at 530-876-3222. That's all you need to do is just pick up the telephone, push those buttons, and we'll be able to chat. Now, here are the recipes. I don't know about you, but during the summer months, well, let's face it, in today's world, we're all busy. And one of my husband's favorite recipes, and we have a very dear friend, that she has fixed stuffed mushrooms for years. And for a long time, they were not something that particularly appealed to me because I'd have different recipes and different things, and I just go, oh, wow, they're not too exciting. But this recipe really seems to have a nice flavor to it, and you can use different meats if you want. Maybe you don't want to use meat. You can do things with this recipe that maybe you wouldn't be able to do with others. So let me give it to you. You need 30 large mushrooms. 30 large mushrooms. You're going to need a half of a medium onion chopped, and you want that onion chopped really, really fine. So if you are smart, you use, you know, a Cuisinart or something. It's really going to do it for you. A pound of cheddar cheese grated. I like the extra strong. A pound of the cheddar cheese grated. A half a pound of ground beef. Now, remember what I said. You can use different types of meat. You could use chicken. Some people like fish. I'm not as fond of fish as I am pork. I really love pork and or beef. And then, and I know we've got a caller, but let me finish this recipe and I'll get right to you. Half a pound of meat. I have 1.5 cups of breadcrumbs. Some garlic powder. You're going to need 1.5 teaspoons of thyme. Have some Ramino cheese, that's R-A-M-I-N-O cheese, and you want that grated, you want that put on the side. You need a can of cream mushroom soup and 1/2 can of water. Okay, now this is what you're going to do. You're going to saute your onions in butter. You add your meat, whatever your choice is, and you want to cook it until it's crumbling. Then you remove it from the heat, add your breadcrumbs, cheddar cheese, all your seasonings, and garlic you do to taste. And you want to use the stems, chop those up finely from your mushrooms. Mix that all together. Then you stuff your caps, and you want to put them on a lightly greased, or within a lightly greased 13-by-9-inch casserole dish. And then you pour your soup over your mushrooms and sprinkle with a Romano cheese, cover with foil, and bake at 350 degrees for 20 minutes. So easy and so good. You could use cream of celery. You could use, you know, even a cheddar cheese soup if you want it. You know, there's all kinds of options. Experiment with it. But these will go like a flash. And they're a meal in and of themselves. Serve it with a light salad if you want. It all depends on what you want to do. But it's light and it's easy, perfect for summer. Let's go to our next caller. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hello, my name is Michael.
Hi, Michael. We're due to go on a break. Will you stay with me and we'll come right back? Where are you calling from, Michael?
Carmel, and that recipe was worth waiting for.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm hungry. We're going to go on.
I'll hang on.
Okay, Michael. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. Don't go away. We'll be back with Michael and you in just a moment.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again,
872-8852. Hi, well, this is Donna Sebo. We're coming back with Michael. If you want to give me a call, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756 if you're in Canada. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Okay, let's get down to seeing what's happening with you. I am looking at you in a vehicle, and even with the price of gasoline, you're going to be traveling. But you know what? You've got a wonderful attitude. You are looking at really expanding your contacts with people, and you are doing it with a very strong sense of purpose. But more than just the purpose, there is a openness and a generosity with you in your communications with people, and they're going to be responding in such a wonderful way. I really think that with the traveling for communication and involvement with people that I see you doing, the results are going to be excellent. You are going to leave a very good impression with these people that you're interviewing with, interacting with. There is a good sense of camaraderie. There's a good sense of trust, and you will have earned it. Now, there is going to be a proposal that you are going to be putting before someone. And what I think is so invaluable about how you are doing this is that it is, I am giving it to this person. If they want to use it, fine. If they don't, that's okay, too. I'd love for them to do it, but I'm not going to be pushy. I'm just not going to try to force it. I'm going to say, these are my concepts and ideas, however you're going to use your words. And this person is going to be so impressed with that. And you're going to walk away saying, I'm going to leave this with you, and you tell me, when would you like me to give you a call back on this? Then they give you a time, you'll say, thanks, I appreciate that, and that's exactly what you'll do. There's not going to be any heavy pressure for salesmanship or a sense of desperation with it. I am watching this with such interest because I am seeing the results that will be forthcoming, not immediately, but in time. It's like you're putting out little seeds in very fertile soil, and the sprouts of opportunity are going to come up in their own time frame. It may not be in that moment, but it'll benefit you later on. You're leaving a good impression with everywhere that you're going, and that's important. You're planting positive seeds. You will get a little bit discouraged because you're not going to feel as if things are happening quickly enough, but I want to say there's a lot going on behind the scenes that you cannot see. And because you can't see it, does not mean it's not working. It's like letting go, release it. Do what you have to do, let it go, release it, and move on.
Huh.
And you're going to be very pleased with the results. You know, when a farmer or a gardener puts seeds in the ground, if they keep digging it up to see, are you growing yet? It'll often die. It won't work. It has to have its time to gain its own energy, its own strength, and to recognize what it's wanting to do. And so that's what you're doing right now, is sowing the seeds.
Okay.
I hope that makes sense to you.
Actually, it does. It's exactly what me and another guy are trying to do, propose something to someone.
All right, but remember, this isn't the only person in the world to make the proposal to.
Okay.
This is one of many.
Okay. So the idea doesn't necessarily have to stay with this person.
That's correct.
But the idea we have is good. It just could go anywhere, right?
It has many different applications. You will need to look at the niche that you may want to focus on, but you should be flexible enough to recognize when it fits into something else.
Okay.
Don't try to put it in a box that's a one-inch square.
Okay, I will just sow the seeds just like I'm doing. I'm just throwing a bunch of stuff out, trying to see what'll stick.
You got it.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.
Did you have a question for me, Michael?
Well, it's regarding that in my career. I mean, I want to see something go forward. And
what's your career, Michael?
I'm in sales right now, and I'm just kind of at a dead end with what I'm doing. And I'm trying to make a big change in my life, even though I'm...
Well, instead of trying to make a gigantic change,
yeah,
why don't you just take little tiny steps?
Okay.
Why don't you take little tiny steps and explore? See what arenas you'd really like to be involved with and ask yourself why.
Okay.
You might decide you want to be associated with the dairy industry, or maybe you want to get into women's clothing or something else. The fact that you enjoy sales is very important. Good salespeople are hard to find. So you want to remember that what you love most is what you want to be involved with, but what do you want to be associated with? And this has to be according to your measure, not someone else's.
Okay. I got you. I'll do some exploring, exactly what you're saying. And
well,
I won't
Michael,
make a drastic
it's been a delight.
Change.
Thank you for calling in today.
You're welcome.
This is Donna Sebo. My gracious, this hour just went by like the wind. I had another recipe for cheese balls that I was going to share with you, but I could save that for tomorrow, can't I? I mean, there's always good opportunities to talk about food. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You know, I think about the man we talked about today. He is a literary genius, Hamlin Garland. I didn't know anything about him, but someone took the time to remember him. Don't ever feel that you do not have value in life. You do. That the world may not recognize you at one point, that's okay. What's important is that you live your life with the quality and value of integrity and purpose that is most meaningful to you as a human being, as an individual. And then the world, well, it's always going to have its opinions, and it's going to flow like the wind, changing every single moment. Just believe in yourself. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Brigadier General Ezell Ware, Jr. He is currently retired. This is a phenomenal story about a man in Vietnam and a war mission that involved a black man with a Ku Klux Klan partner. Ah, does that intrigue you? It should. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. Join me tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com, The Donna Sebo Show. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.